Hello, and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I am so excited to be with you all and to discuss the idea of the artist in society. And today, the person who will be discussing that with me is a very special guest and my dear brother, Joel Clarkson.
Hi, everyone.
If you are a special or faithful listener to the podcast, you will have heard Joel in several episodes. He has helped me out a lot. It was easy to have him help me out because last year we lived in the same flat together in Scotland and we got snowed in and it was cold and dark. So we did lots of projects together in the depths of winter. So you probably will have heard him on the book club when we did The Great Divorce of the summer. He did several of those episodes with me, and he's even recorded a few segments all to himself. And he is my unofficial, but official to me, advisor when it comes to doing the music segments on the regular podcast, because he has a degree from Berkeley. And he did the same master's that I did here at St. Andrews and focused on choral music and sacred music. So Joel is kind of the person to go to if you want information on music and on artistry. And so he felt like a good person to talk to. But before I get going much further, why don't you tell us what you're up to in life at the moment, Joel, and give us the background on who you are.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know me, as Joy said, I went to Berklee College of Music. I have a degree in composition. I worked in film music for a while. I continue to do some of that. I'm a concert composer. I've sort of dipped my fingers into a lot of different arenas when it comes to music and continue to enjoy doing sort of new things as they come up the pipeline. But I've especially focused on sacred music in the last several years. And that's led me ultimately to study here at St. Andrews, where I have done some research on theology and sacred music and silence and incarnational presence. And that was sort of what I did for my master's. And I enjoyed it so much that I decided I wanted to continue that on into doctoral studies. And so I'm now working on a PhD here at St. Andrews, and I'll be looking at sacred music and sacrament and other things like that related to how we sort of experience music and worship and what helps us to accomplish.
A fun thing about Joel is that we had a few years in which our lives kind of didn't overlap. When you went to college and then when I went to college on the opposite coast. But then somewhere along the way, over the last few years, we have gotten to kind of share several significant seasons. So we were both in Colorado for the same year, if you remember that. And then we got to share being in Scotland together. And so we've kind of gotten to have a lot of adventures together and share similar seasons of life. And so it's been really special to be able to share that specifically in St. Andrews. And the other thing that's fun about Joel is that, with me, is that we do music together sometimes, don't
indeed.
We, Joel?
We do indeed.
We started a band. I remember it was on a road trip back when I was moving back from California for my undergrad. I don't know if you remember this. And we were driving with Elena, who's somebody else you will have heard. Mm-hmm. And we started playing each other all the songs that we liked, that we admired their writing. And then I said, well, I've written a couple of songs. And you said you had two. And so we played some of the kind of demos that we'd written. And we thought, we should do music together. This is silly. So we did. And we've recorded two EPs. And we're always kind of in the process of recording a third one. But we've been pretty busy lately. So you can find those on Spotify or wherever music is.
Yep, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon.
And I feel like we have a mutually beneficial relationship when it comes to discovering music.
Yeah.
Because if I want to know, let's say I want to make a playlist that is of film scores or beautiful orchestral music or of great choral music or of great classical guitar music, I know that you're the person I can go to.
Yes. And if I want to do a playlist of alternative songwriting or interesting pop that's come out recently or something that's flown under the radar that's really a good songwriting of some sort, Joy keeps her ear to the ground and knows all the stuff that's around. So I always know to go to her.
So we share a love of music, and that's kind of something we bond over. But today I wanted to have Joel on to talk with you about the idea of the artist in society and what role should the artist play? And a lot of this came to me because I've been doing a good bit of study on romanticism and for my PhD. And out of Romanticism emerges this picture of the artist or the poet who is someone who's usually depressed, usually kind of chaotic, and you can't count on them. And they go into flurries of productivity, and then they get depressed. And it's this very kind of specific image of the artist. And their role is to express themselves. And it's interesting because I was realizing that when I think in my mind of artists in society, if I were not to kind of, you know, filter my image, that's very similar to what I would think. I would think of the point of the artist is to have self-expression. They're usually moody. They're divas. They need everything just right. And the wonderful thing is that Joel is a true artist. You are a composer. You really are a working artist. Mm-hmm. And I do not see those stereotypes reflected in your life. You are not the, you know, I mean, we all have our moody and our deep moments. And I think there's a certain emotional depth you have to be an artist. But to me, what I see in Joel's work is that art is not just for self-expression. It doesn't have to be. It can be for something greater than that. So I wanted to pick your brain on what you think the artist is for in society and what it takes to be an artist, what it's like to be an artist. So what I'm going to begin today with is I'm going to read you a passage from a letter that Joel wrote for the Theophilus Institute, which I will attach in the show notes. It's a letter to... Letter to a young artist. And I'm just going to read you a portion. It's a fairly lengthy portion, so buckle in before we start today's discussion. So this is what it says. As far as composing is concerned, technique is a wonderful thing, and every excellent composer needs to develop it. But how much time do you spend developing your soul? What are you reading lately? How often do you get outside and spend time in nature? Are you developing friendships and making liturgical rhythms towards yours and their betterment? Your artistry doesn't come from a vacuum. It emerges from a pattern of soul enrichment you are weaving day to day. Artistry only grows in good soil, and to cultivate good soil, you need to engage in much more than music. If your creative well is dry right now, that doesn't mean you don't still have the opportunity to grow as an artist. Spend that downtime developing what you believe about your artistry. Too many artists create without knowing why they create. Who you are is just as important as what you do, because what you do emerges out of who you are. Discovering and articulating your story is one of the best things you can possibly do as a composer. I say this because I was often told by profs along the way that I cared too much about thematic writing and needed to learn to love music for its own sake and to write for no other purpose than my own pure compositional expression. With due respect to those excellent composition profs to whom I owe a great debt of gratitude, that's rubbish. Music, which is written for its own sake, leads to a worship of music, turning what ought to be an icon into a window through which God's presence is glimpsed, into an idol, an end in itself. Music, like all art, is a means towards an end. Artistry is very similar to language. In language, we can communicate about concepts and ideas through explication, attempting to concretize and manifest. In art, we are mediating that which can't be understood through explication, but only through encounter. Art is a means of transmitting truth by way of experience when mere words fail to communicate. This has enormous implications for innovation. Rather than trying to create out of thin air, composition becomes a means of communicating what is true through the lens of our experience, our emotions, our inner eyes. It is imbued with immense power. I'm far less interested in how a composer innovates than in what they conserve. What do you protect and defend with your music? So I loved that there's a much longer letter, which you should all go and read. But I loved reading this because, to me, it was a peek inside kind of what I think you see as the vocation of an artist, the responsibility of an artist to society, to church, to the people around us. So Joel, I would love to hear you just kind of talk about what do you think kind of the responsibility or the vocation of an artist is in today's world?
Yeah, well, I think picking up sort of on the note of this, this letter in particular was written to somebody I was in conversation with who was dealing with a dry spell artistically and wondering kind of how to face that and what to do about it. Those dry spells are really sort of interesting crystallized moments in the artistic life, because if the artist truly is unto themselves and the point of their artistry is to sort of like create out of the sort of the font of individual knowledge and sort of create ex nihilo, as it were, then that dry spell represents a failure. It represents an emptiness. But if you think about that dry spell in the context of some of what you've just heard, that artistry is a response to the world, that artistry is a response to God's work in our lives, then what it actually becomes is a space in which to listen, in which to grow, in which to gather. And in that space of gathering and growing and listening and sort of synthesizing those elements, you're preparing for something new to come about. So I think that those dry spells actually speak to something very specific about the artist's vocation, that we live within silence and we manifest presence within it. That's part of our calling as artists, is to listen well and to exist well within the world itself, to hear how God is speaking. And so I, as an artist, I feel like it's really important to be not sort of cut off from reality so that I can have some sort of unique absolute statement with my music, but actually deeply connected to it, because that is what actually enriches my artistic expression.
Absolutely. And I think that something that comes out of that too is the idea of creating for. And in this, you talked about how your professors wanted you to kind of create for the sake of music itself. But historically, this has just really not been the case. Usually, music, art was created for something. It was created for a purpose. And oftentimes, it was created for the purposes of worship. And, you know, when it comes to this idea of the artist, this really was more comprised in the language of what we might call a craftsman before about the 18th century. So it used to be that the greatest works of visual art were created for churches, for altarpieces, for windows. And the artist maybe might have lived in the same place or worshiped in the church which they created for. And the musician created music for church, for to sing and worship, to sing for masses. And so I think that part of what I see for you is a sense that your role, we don't live in quite that communal of a society anymore, but your role is to communicate, is to create for people. It's not just kind of this abstract thing.
Yes.
How would you respond to that? Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think we are obligated to each other. I think that part of the great harm of artistry in the contemporary society is that it privileges the artist as a special kind of person who doesn't need to be within and amongst. It's sort of an inhumane way of looking at the artist, because it's both a harm to them because it cuts them off from their belonging to society. And it also sort of, I think it backfires, because rather than privileging the art, it actually sort of makes it something that is not part of it's not part and parcel of the day-to-day life that we all live and that we interact with. And go back to some of what I was saying in the letter itself, I do believe that art is, and you know, I speak to this as a musician, I do think that music is something which both responds to and which carries forward, and that it actually does do more than simply act as a novelty. It acts as something which is fundamental to our existence. It helps us be more human. And when we privilege art in this sort of category onto itself, we're actually, in a weird way, in a way that backfires, suggesting that art isn't actually meaningful in a sense. It's sort of special and set apart.
It's like a hobby, rather than saying, music is necessary to worship. And so it's something that uniquely and specially draws us into God's presence and responds to the beauty and God's presence in the world.
Yeah. So if music is naturally attached to our existence, if it's something that's fundamental to the way that we become humans that flourish rather than just survive or exist, then that means there is some sort of obligation we have for those of us who are artists or who are musicians to consider that sensibility and to consider ourselves within a particular context and how we speak back to people through our music.
Yes. And I think a part of this too is that oftentimes we think of art, I think, in our society as being something that you kind of need to be able to boil down and then replicate and then sell. That we create products, that art is a product, and that it's kind of a luxury product.
Yeah.
When this was so not how it was thought of many years ago, I remember going to Salisbury Cathedral, which has the tallest tower in all, I think all of the UK, I know all of the UK, and I think actually maybe Europe. It kind of like added a few bricks just to top itself over. Mm-hmm. But when you're in there, there's these beautiful carvings everywhere. And I remember the person talking to us about how many of the stonesmiths or the stonemasons who would be there, that it would be a work of their entire life to give to the cathedral, that they would, that they would hew these beautiful statues, and probably their, often their signature would be that they would make one of the gargoyles their own face. Mm-hmm. But that the peak of their artistry was in giving themselves not to a product they could sell, but to a lasting thing that their community could enjoy. Mm. And so something I've often thought about is I would love to encourage, let's say we have listeners that are, artists in some sense, they have a skill, they have a capacity, but they feel discouraged, or they feel like their art will never go outside the realm of their community, or outside of, you know, they may not be the big break. But what I would say to you, and I've seen this very much in your life, and I want to ask you about a specific example of this in a minute, is that you should not think poorly of your ability to contribute beauty and to play that role for your own small community. This has been the role that artists have played for many, many years. It's not, you can, through your skill and gift, have the pinnacle that many artists throughout all of the centuries have had, which is to give something lasting and beautiful that will make people worship God and know him better to your own community. And an example of this, I feel for you, was that last year you used your gift of music to compose something for our church. So why don't you tell them a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I've wanted to do this for a long time. I you know, sort of, as mentioned earlier, I've worked in film, I've worked in concert music, I've written all sorts of different kinds of music for different settings, radio and podcasts and audiobook. I've done audiobook narration, and I've done all sorts of different audio and music. But I've wanted for a long time to think about how to use my music to speak into the setting that I'm already part of. And I was really privileged last year to get to work with my local church here in writing a piece of music for the liturgy out of my experience of singing in the liturgy. I've been a bass scholar, which basically means I've been brought on board to sing regular services at this church for the past year and a half. And out of that experience and participating every week, sometimes multiple times a week in the liturgy as a singer, I've been able to sort of receive something both artistically and spiritually that I have desired to sort of express back through my artistry. And again, the value is that I've found in that has been immense, because rather than simply writing for a sort of a theoretical idea or something, I'm writing out of the very grounded reality of my experience. And this is the beauty of music. In a Christian framework, what we're doing is we're admitting that what we believe is both tangible and real in the person of Christ, and yet participates in a reality far beyond our understanding. And so that's a mystery that we have to sort of find a way to exist within. A music as something which is both tangible. We hear it.
We feel it in our chest.
We feel it when we sing it, but it's not actually touchable or seeable in a sense. It has both that sense of tangibility and intangibility. So it helps us to interpret that sense of the engagement between the physical and the spiritual. It helps us to understand something about the incarnation of Christ, this person who we worship, who is both man and who is God. He has existed within our framework of time and space, and yet he is the eternal reigning king in heaven. And so music actually speaks really powerfully to this. And that if that's what music is helping us to do, then being able to do that within the context of worship is something really powerful. So for me, I was thinking, as a person embodied in this world who attends a particular sort of liturgy in a particular place, how can I speak to this and do it as part of my own community? And that was really rewarding.
Yes, I think that's wonderful. And I think that what you are discussing, what you're saying, is this idea of music playing this role of kind of ushering us along the path between what is embodied and experienced and what is transcendent. And music has this wonderful capacity to be able to do that. It lifts us. And I love the passage in The Weight of Glory, which is one of my favorite Lewis writings. And it was a sermon he gave in Oxford, but he talks about how all the music and books and all the beautiful things we saw that we thought the beauty was there, what really happened was that the beauty came through it. And I think that when we enjoy a beautiful piece of music, the reason it's so useful and important for worship is that something comes through music to us that draws us to that intangible, to that beyond.
Absolutely.
And helps kind of usher us there. And it was amazing. So what did you compose for church?
I composed two things. It was a two-part composition. It was what is regularly called a set of canticles. So in traditional evensong worship in the Anglican tradition, there's the Canticle of Mary, which is the Magnificat, and that's always sung after the Old Testament reading. And then there's the canticle, it's the Nunc Dimittis, which is the Canticle of Simeon. And that canticle is always sung after the New Testament reading. So you have Mary's song, My Soul Magnifies the Lord, praising God for the promises fulfilled in the presence of Christ, responding to what's sort of hinted at in the Old Testament. And then you have Simeon responding to the sort of manifestation of that in the New Testament. Lord, lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word, for my eyes have seen thy glory. It's a benediction in a sense. It's a recognition that something has been completed. And so you have these two incredible canticles, and those are usually in a sung evensong. Those have been set countless times by incredible composers throughout the years. And so I wanted to enter into that tradition as well. So I set both the Magnificat and the Nunc Dimittis for music.
And then it was performed for an evensong at our church. Mm-hmm. And it was really a remarkable experience because I got to experience as a member, of course. And I was so overwhelmed. I was meant to record the actual pieces, but I was so overwhelmed because it was so beautiful that I forgot to record half of them. But it was amazing. It was on, what was the feast day? It was the feast of...
I think it might've been Corpus Christi.
It was Corpus Christi, which is the feast of the body of Christ.
Right.
And...
which is, again, appropriate because if we're talking about the...
The tangible and the intangible.
Yeah.
The mystical and the present.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was on this beautiful day. Didn't one of the bishops was preaching?
I think there was a bishop preaching.
Yes, and it was this really remarkable experience because the bishop came in and he was wearing this kind of purple, shiny, golden, it kind of almost looked like it couldn't have been an earthly material. It came shimmering down, you know, the middle and then this beautiful piece of music. And the readings were all also very otherworldly because it was Ezekiel, will you tell these dry bones to stand up? And anyway, as a participant, I felt drawn into this utterly otherworldly experience that I believed. You know what I mean? That it was this experience that it makes it possible for you to believe in that.
Yeah.
And it was also really special because we had some friends come who normally wouldn't be church attenders. Mm. And I thought, on the one hand, I thought, wow, this is like the weirdest day for them to come. You know, this is Ezekiel and all this madness. But it was so beautiful and it was wonderful to be able to talk to them. Not just about the ideas behind Christianity, but the experience of it, the experience of God's beauty and his transcendence. And I remember the bishop giving this rousing, do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
This rousing sermon about God's presence in the grandeur of the world. And it just felt all very fitting. But it was also very special because you wrote this for our church.
Yes.
For the people that we sit with every day. And it was suitable and fitting to the church.
Yes. Yeah. That was perhaps the most rewarding part. It was that I didn't want to write it as my expression, as my thing, but as something that belonged to all of us as a congregation that we all got to own. I was simply the person who helped to sort of shepherd this into existence. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a wonderful feeling that we were able together to sort of grow through this and to worship God more fully.
I love James McMillan, who is a Scottish composer, often uses the language of midwifery. He says that artists, particularly musicians, are the midwives of faith, that they kind of guide and bring us towards this place of worship. And I felt very much that happened that night. Mm. And it was also very special as a sister to watch how much the people in the church enjoyed it. And it was a very special night. So I think in my mind, Joel, that is a picture of what I think the vocation of the artist is. The artist is to respond to the world around him, to not to draw people into expressions of themselves and just to look further and further inward, but to be drawn outwards, to be drawn towards worship, to respond to the world around them. And then specifically to do that, not just for profit, not just for kind of the big nameless, faceless international world, but for their place, for their church.
Yeah.
And
to change their mentality about what the value that you get out of creating, what it is that you want to receive out of that.
Yes. And in some ways it was amazing because obviously you were this incredible artisan who did this so well, but you kind of disappeared and the music, you disappeared into the beauty and the artistry of the music.
Yeah.
And then the artistry of the music kind of disappeared into the glory that it drew us into. Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful picture. Mm-hmm. So I would say to anyone listening, don't half-heartedly cultivate your artistic skills because you don't think that you will be, you know, the next big thing.
Yeah.
Cultivate them deeply and skillfully, and then give them to the community that you are in.
And fully invest. Don't think of your artistic expression as simply, you know, if you're a musician, for instance, learning about harmony and tonality and counterpoint. Those are so important, and they are vital to knowing how to write. But equally important is how you build your soul, what you read, the people you spend time with. Those things inform who you are as an artist.
And because they are what you'll be giving back.
Yeah. So as you think about how to develop yourself, consider those things as deeply important to your artistic development.
And kind of to end on a fun but also practical note, I want to ask you, Joel, what it looks like to be an artist. Because I think mm-hmm. that in our minds, also to have to do with the Romantics, because they were always going around fainting and taking laudanum, we have this picture of artists kind of being very like they need to have the perfect environment. I remember somebody saying, well, you know, you can't write a book unless you have this exact routine where everything works every day. And I thought, well, shoot, I will never write a book. But as I've watched you and I've watched kind of your workmanship, mm-hmm. your diligence, you're not super precious about the way that you go about working.
I try not to be.
So yeah. Tell us, what does it look like to compose a piece? What does that look like in the discipline of your life?
Yeah, I think, you know, in some ways, it's almost a luxury that only a very few people ever get to enjoy. And in some sense, I don't think I would ever want that preciousness. Yeah. I actually appreciate the interruptedness in some sense of the rhythms of life. That's just the natural way that we all exist, and it keeps us connected. But so my natural rhythm is that I do set aside spaces to write. And when I'm in those spaces, I think of it very pragmatically. You know, I was trained as a film composer. And so when you're working on a film, it's usually on short deadlines, and you have to trust that you've developed your instincts appropriately. And that is where that sort of training for counterpoint and harmony and other things come in. It's studying the masters and learning how to do that. So a lot of what I do when I write is I'm considering it a pragmatic thing for me to sort of take what I have received and apply it. And so when I sit down to write, I work for an hour or two sometimes. It depends on the day. If I'm having trouble writing, or if it's just not working, I might try for a little bit and then take a break. Sometimes you just have to let the day be the day and move on with your life and have a nice meal or go out for a walk. But I try to just, if I've set aside time to write, I just sit down and write as much as I can. It's kind of like it is with authors who are writing a creative book. You hear this from a lot of people who are trying to write a novel. The most important thing is just to get words on a page or notes on a page. That's the key. You can always go back and edit later. But the main thing is just, you know, to sort of keep at it. And that's more or less my process.
From an external view, from my view, kind of living with you and watching you compose this last year, mm-hmm. it looks a lot to me, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, it looks a lot like tinkering. Like you'd work on it here, you'd work on it there.
Definitely.
If we had a few minutes, you would work on it, but it wasn't like this, you know, fainting thing where you worked on it and you put time into it and you were diligent.
No, who has time or energy for that?
And it makes me think of, you know, one of the greatest composers ever, of course, is Bach.
Mm-hmm.
And Bach had an abundance of children, was always in debt and never had time to be precious about it.
Right.
And I always think of that when I think of composing or writing. In my life right now, I have to not be precious about writing, but just seeing it as a thing of great worth that you can give and something that takes a lot of character and diligence and tinkering and fiddling away on.
It does. It does. And I think that's exactly the right way to think about it. I actually personally think that the sort of the pressures and the interruptions are good. They develop us because it means that we have to become a little bit more focused and a little bit more intentional about our writing. And it helps actually to make writing a little bit more direct and crafted. You know, you learn to get your, and that was the way it was with film for me.
Yeah.
I mean, in some senses I have more luxury than I've ever had after working in film. Film was, you know, writing 45 minutes of orchestrations in 2 weeks, which is just madness.
Overwhelming.
Yeah. And I have a lot more time now than I used to. And so in that sense, I feel like I've been given a generous and wonderful space.
Okay, so I'm going to end with one question that I didn't prepare you for, which is I want you to give me three of your favorite composers.
Hmm, interesting.
People they might enjoy listening to.
Okay, well, I'll give you three composers from different points. Joy mentioned Bach, and I do think he's well known, but I do think everyone should spend time with Bach. When I first started learning composing, the first thing they make you do is they make you sit down, study Bach chorales, and then write out Bach chorales of your own in the style of Bach. When you learn counterpoint, the first thing you learn is a counterpoint in the style of Bach using his rules, because he was the master. And so I think from an inside composer's perspective, everyone should spend time with Bach. And the second reason for that is because he's just delightful. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer. His music is so rich and so full, and there's so much of it that even if you don't like one thing, you can just move along and there will eventually be something you'll find in Bach. So I love Bach. I also love Brahms. I think Joy could speak more to this in terms of her knowledge of the Romantic era, but I think Brahms is in the sort of the tradition of the masters, including Bach and Beethoven and others. And he wanted to be. He was both a composer and a conductor. He was a very popular conductor throughout his life. And he really, really studied, very studious. He was a very studious researcher of classical counterpoint and of Baroque counterpoint, and wanted his music to be invested in that. And his sense of the Romantic was always rooted in tradition. There's been a lot of debate about what kind of faith he had, but no matter what kind of faith he had, he was very dedicated to his Lutheran background, and a lot of his music and many of his choral works come out of that, including his masterpiece, the German Requiem. And so I think Brahms is a brilliant composer to spend time with. And then I would say I also really love, in the contemporary era, I love Arvo Pärt. Arvo Pärt is an Estonian composer. He's actually the most performed composer in the world. Living composer in the world. He writes in what has been called, although I don't know if he would accept this terminology, mystic minimalism. And effectively, it's this very sparse, open, but very beautiful music. And he's Estonian Orthodox. So he comes from a tradition which is very invested in the way that music speaks to the mystical experience that we have in the Christian life. But at the same time, he's lived in Vienna for much of his life, in Berlin. He spent a lot of time in the West and is very interested in, again, in the tradition. He is extremely knowledgeable in the tradition. He's used sacred texts from both East and West, and those play a very, very important part in his music. And I just love listening to his music. He captures my imagination in a way that very few people do.
I think that something that I will do is I will get a few recommendations of specific pieces from you, mm-hmm. and I'll put that in the show notes.
Wonderful.
So everyone make sure to go look at that, and you can find some recommendations from Joel. Well, Joel, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been so delightful to talk to you and to hear your thoughts about this. I want to tell people where they can go to discover your music and more about you.
Wonderful. Well, there's two places that I would suggest. The first is Instagram. I post regularly on Instagram because I'm an avid photographer. Part of the way that I develop my interest in music is by going out and spending time in nature, and I take a lot of pictures when I do that. So
his is beautiful. It'll add loveliness to your life.
Yes, I hope so. I hope so. I just love sharing it. So, and my Instagram handle is JIC Music Guy. And then if you would like to sort of keep up with my news of new releases and anything that's going on, any appearances I'm making, the best place to do that is facebook.com/ Joel Clarkson Music. And then finally, if you're interested in my music itself, you can listen to my music and purchase it on my store, on my website, which is joelclarkson.com/store. So I hope you'll take the chance to follow me. I'd love to continue to engage with, I just so enjoy that on Instagram and Facebook and other places.
I will say that I often listen to Joel's music while I study, and I think that if a prophet is without honor in his own family, and even I listen to Joel, I think you can find that he's highly recommended. Joel, thank you so much, and thank you to everyone listening. I wish you well, and I hope you will tune in next week for more Speaking with Joy.